Be Your Own Hero: How to Save Yourself from Yourself. Written by Justice O. Malcolm. Published by Audiobooks Office. Introduction. I've spent a good portion of my life watching people try to outrun themselves. They chase careers, lovers, crises, and occasionally enlightenment, as if salvation waits somewhere outside the boundaries of their own skin. I used to be one of them. Before I taught wilderness survival, before I ever thought of myself as any kind of mentor, and before I learned what it actually means to lead myself, I was an Olympic-level escapist, not in the dramatic sense. I didn't disappear into mountain monasteries or fake my own death, though I won't pretend those ideas didn't cross my mind once or twice. My version of running was quieter, overworking, overthinking, and overpleasing. I ran until I could no longer tell the difference between exhaustion and purpose. Strange how the body always knows before the mind does. Mine eventually staged a mutiny. It was subtle at first, missed meals, numb mornings, the kind of bone-deep fatigue that turns every simple task into a pilgrimage. Then came the bigger signs, a breakup that hollowed me, a job that drained more than it gave, and a creeping sense that my life was something happening to me rather than something I was choosing. I was a wilderness instructor at the time, teaching people how to build shelters, track weather patterns, and navigate terrain. I could coax life from damp tinder and find my way through forests in the dark, but I couldn't seem to navigate the far messier wilderness of my own mind. One day, while teaching a group how to read the landscape, I heard myself say, "If you don't know where you are, you can't know where you're going." Something about the words felt like a stone tossed into still water. They echoed in me. I realized I was speaking to myself as much as to them. I knew how to situate my body in space, but not my spirit in my own life, and it struck me, quietly, without drama, that what I needed wasn't another survival tactic, but a kind of leadership that comes from within, the kind you can't outsource to a teacher or partner or therapist. It wasn't about conquering my demons or fixing every flaw. It was about finally taking responsibility for the way I showed up to my own existence. Self-leadership is a romantic term in theory. It conjures images of confident, decisive people marching purposefully toward their destinies. In reality, it's much messier. It looks like sitting in the silence you've avoided. It looks like admitting you've been the villain in your own story more often than you'd like. It looks like recognizing that the parts of you you're ashamed of aren't obstacles to overcome but messages you've ignored. And sometimes, when you're lucky, it looks like forgiveness, the quiet kind that happens without ceremony. When I say be your own hero, I don't mean slay every dragon in sight, or strive to become some mythic version of yourself who wakes up at 5 every morning and never misses a workout or a journaling session. I mean something far more subtle and far more demanding. Save yourself from the places within you where you've hidden, abandoned, or betrayed yourself. Lead yourself not with force, but with presence. Learn to trust your own voice, not the loud one that panics or doubts, but the steady one underneath that has been whispering the truth for years. Self-leadership is the art of taking ownership of your inner terrain, not controlling it, not dominating it, not polishing it until it sparkles. Ownership. The willingness to look honestly at what's there. The courage to make choices aligned with your real values. The discipline to keep steering yourself back when you inevitably drift. The tenderness to recognize that growth isn't linear and falling apart isn't failure. In the wilderness, if you lose your bearings, the worst thing you can do is panic. People who panic run in circles, they dehydrate faster, they miss the signs, animal tracks, water sources, the way light falls across the land. The same is true internally. Most of us don't get lost because we're incapable, we get lost because we won't stop long enough to see clearly. We run in circles inside our own heads, repeating old patterns and calling them fate. You don't need a map of who you should become. You need a deeper relationship with who you already are. This book is my attempt to hand you a compass, not the directional kind, but the inner kind, the one that reorients you toward yourself. I won't pretend I have all the answers. Anyone who claims they do is selling something, and it's usually snake oil. What I do have are the lessons forged from my own storms, the insights earned the slow and unglamorous way, and a stubborn belief that every person, no matter how lost, has the capacity to lead themselves home. As we walk through these chapters together, I'll ask you to consider questions you may have avoided. I'll offer stories, some triumphant, some embarrassing, from times when I failed spectacularly and the strange gifts those failures left behind. I'll nudge you toward truths you probably already know but haven't fully stepped into yet. And I'll remind you, over and over, that self-leadership isn't a destination. It's a practice, a daily act of returning to yourself with honesty and compassion. If you're here reading this, I'm guessing you're tired of outsourcing your life to circumstance or fear. You're ready to stop running in circles. You want to stand in your own center, steadier, clearer, and more awake. Good. That's all you need to start. To read the complete book, visit our website and get the complete ebook, now available on the website at audiobooksoffice.com. Welcome to the journey. Let's walk it together. Chapter 1. The call to lead yourself. The moment you realize no one is coming to save you rarely arrives with cinematic fanfare. There's no thunderclap, no sweeping orchestral score. More often it comes in the quiet. Those unguarded minutes when your defenses are down and life catches you without your practiced answers. Sometimes it comes as a hollow ache in the chest, a whispered thought you almost miss. Other times it arrives as a crisis, not because the universe is cruel, but because you've ignored the gentler invitations for too long. However it arrives, the call to lead yourself tends to be subtle enough to doubt and unmistakable enough to haunt you once you've heard it. My own call arrived like that, half whisper, half interruption. I was standing in the middle of a sun-bleached valley on a training expedition, watching a group of students navigate their first solo challenge. They were scattered across the terrain, clutching maps with a mix of fear and determination, the kind of earnestness that made me want to shield them from both the elements and their own anxiety. Teaching survival had taught me 1,000 lessons about the wild, but it had also taught me a great deal about what humans do when they're afraid, and how easily fear convinces us that surrender is wisdom. I watched them second-guess themselves, tracing routes with trembling fingers, hoping someone else would confirm the path they already suspected was right. I saw myself in them far more than I like to admit. One woman, maybe in her mid-40s, stood frozen at a crossroads in the trail. I could see her lips moving, muttering a soft chorus of doubt. She kept glancing back at me, as if I held an answer she wasn't yet brave enough to claim for herself. I smiled and nodded her onward, resisting the urge to shout directions. If I led her step by step, she'd finish the hike, but she wouldn't gain the thing she came for. Survival training isn't about teaching people to endure the wild. It's about teaching them to trust themselves inside of it. And trust is worthless if it's always borrowed. As she finally took her tentative step forward, I felt a peculiar punch of clarity. It hit me that I had been waiting, quite childishly if I'm being honest, for someone else to nod me forward in my own life. I was supposed to be the guide, the one who'd learned to read landscapes, both internal and external, yet there I was, half listening to the quiet plea inside me that said, "Please tell me what to do. Please make the decision for me. Please carry the responsibility I keep dropping." It's unsettling to realize you've built an entire identity around strength and capability while quietly outsourcing your deepest choices to fear or circumstance. I had been doing that for years. I thought if I smiled brightly, worked hard enough, and gathered enough skills, confidence would come marching in like a well-trained soldier. Instead, my life became a carefully crafted choreography, one that protected me from risk, but also from growth. I could teach someone else to light a fire with damp wood, but I couldn't seem to ignite one in myself. Self-leadership begins in that precise moment of recognition, the moment you become aware that you're waiting for permission to be the author of your own life. It's one of the hardest recognitions to accept, because it demands humility without humiliation. It asks you to see yourself clearly, without filters or excuses, and then to forgive what you see so you can choose differently. It's easy to blame circumstance or other people or the limits of your upbringing. It's harder to admit that at some point you stopped steering. I used to think the call to lead myself would come like a lightning bolt, shattering the illusion and leaving me with a single undeniable truth. But the real call was more like a tapping on a door I kept walking past. It would show up in small embarrassments, like the time I realized I was saying yes to everything simply because I was terrified of disappointing anyone, or in the way I avoided decisions until they made themselves for me, or in the aching suspicion that the life I was living was technically fine, but profoundly not mine. People imagine leadership as standing at the front, confident and declarative. But the first act of self-leadership isn't boldness, it's honesty. Brutal, disarming honesty. It's looking at the life you've built and asking, is this me? Or is this the version of me that felt safest to become? Those questions are unsettling, because they don't just poke at your choices, they poke at your identity. They make you examine the scaffolding you've built around your insecurities. The roles you've played to be accepted, the places you've shrunk because expansion felt dangerous. The call to lead yourself doesn't ask you to burn your life down. It asks you to stop abandoning yourself inside it. Over the years, I've learned that many people miss their call to self-leadership because they expect it to arrive when they feel ready. But readiness is a mirage. Most of us only become ready by beginning awkwardly, inconsistently, and with the gnawing fear that we're about to ruin everything. I've sat with countless students and later with clients who said, I'll start when I'm stronger, or I'll take the leap when I'm more confident, or my personal favorite, I just need a sign. The truth, uncomfortable as it is that signs are everywhere. We just prefer the ones that don't require us to change. I ignored my signs for years. There were the headaches that arrived like clockwork every time I agreed to something I didn't want, the quiet resentment that curled in my stomach whenever I listened to everyone else's needs while burying my own, the sense of floating through my life like it was happening behind glass. I would have called it numbness back then, but now I know numbness is just unexpressed truth that has nowhere to go. Sometimes the call to lead yourself isn't about changing direction, it's about waking up where you already are. People often ask me what self-leadership looks like in the beginning before it becomes a habit or a way of being. I tell them it looks like mess. It looks like doubt. It looks like choosing the uncomfortable truth over the comfortable lie, even when your voice shakes. It looks like sitting in the discomfort of your own choices long enough to understand them. It looks like choosing alignment over approval, and, perhaps hardest of all, it looks like taking responsibility for the parts of your life you've blamed on fate, or timing, or other people. I've come to believe that responsibility isn't the burden we've made it out to be, it's not a weight, it's a reclamation. It's the difference between living reactively and living intentionally, between being carried by the current and choosing where you place your feet in the water. We use responsibility as a cudgel against ourselves, but when it's paired with compassion, it becomes freedom. The freedom to act, to choose, to change, to forgive, to grow. Responsibility is the moment you stop negotiating with your fears and start negotiating with your future. Of course, hearing the call and answering it are different things. Answering requires a kind of courage that doesn't roar. It's quiet, steady, almost unremarkable from the outside. It's the courage to choose the next right thing, even when you can't see the whole path. The courage to admit when you're lost and recalibrate without shame. The courage to step out of the roles you've mastered and into the self you've neglected. The woman in the valley that day eventually reached the checkpoint. Her steps were slow and uncertain, but they were hers. She approached me with tears in her eyes, not from fear, but from the startling realization that she had trusted her own judgment and lived to tell the tale. I hugged her, dusty and sunburned as we both were, and felt the unmistakable tug of my own lesson rising quietly inside me. No one can lead your life for you, not even someone who loves you, not even someone wiser, not even the version of you who existed before you learned to doubt yourself. Leadership, real leadership, begins the moment you decide to stop waiting. It begins when you gather the scattered parts of yourself, gently but firmly, and say, "Enough. I'm here now." The truth is, self-leadership isn't glamorous. It doesn't offer applause or easy victories. But it does offer something far more valuable, a life that feels inhabited, a life that belongs to you, a life you can stand inside without shrinking. If you've felt that quiet tapping on the door, if you've sensed that something in you is asking for more truth, more courage, more ownership, then consider this your invitation, your call. Not to perfection, not to flawless confidence, but to presence, to participation, to the radical act of taking yourself seriously enough to lead the life that's waiting for you. The wild thing about answering the call is that it doesn't demand transformation overnight. It simply asks you to show up to your choices, your desires, your fears, your contradictions, with a willingness to listen and a willingness to act. You don't need a perfect plan. You need a beginning. This is where the journey starts. Not with certainty, but with willingness. Not with mastery, but with honesty. Not with someone else pointing the way, but with you taking the first step, aware that the terrain ahead is unknown and choosing to walk it anyway. When you feel the tremor of that call again, and you will, don't turn away. Don't wait for permission. Don't assume the timing is wrong. The call to lead yourself isn't something you prepare for, it's something you answer. And now, here you are, answering perhaps without realizing it. Chapter 2. The Wilderness Within. People talk about the wilderness as though it's a place you can point to on a map, those ragged edges of land where the roads give up, where cell signals die, where the terrain stops caring about your convenience. But the longer I've lived, the more convinced I am that the real wilderness isn't out there. It's in here, woven through the unlit corridors of the mind, knotted into the places you avoid, stacked in the memories you'd rather not reopen. The wilderness within doesn't announce itself with howling winds or the rustle of unseen creatures. It announces itself with tension in your throat, with choices you can't make, with the ache of old fears shifting beneath your ribs. It's no less vast than a mountain range, and no less unforgiving. And like any wilderness, it demands a certain kind of respect. I spent years guiding people through forests and deserts and high-altitude plateaus. I could tell you how to identify edible plants, how to spot a storm long before the clouds confess their intentions, how to track a river by the shape of the land. But none of those skills prepared me for the internal terrain I had neglected. Outwardly, I was competent, even impressive. Inwardly, I was a novice, stumbling through brambles of self-doubt, falling into ravines I didn't know existed, circling the same territory like a lost hiker, convinced each familiar tree marked progress. I had mapped the external world with precision, but inside myself, I was wandering without compass or direction, relying on instinct so muted it barely whispered. The truth that took me too long to accept is that the inner wilderness operates by its own laws, laws that don't bend just because you want an easier path. The parts of yourself you've repressed don't disappear. They become thicker undergrowth. The emotions you've left unspoken gather like fog. The dreams you've dismissed without examination become broken branches underfoot that trip you when you least expect it. You can't dominate this landscape. You can't tame it. You can only learn to walk through it with awareness and humility, because everything inside you exists for a reason, even the parts that terrify you. My first real confrontation with my inner wilderness didn't arrive during a crisis or a heartbreak or the typical breaking points that force people into introspection. It came during a quiet stretch of days in my late 20s when everything in my life appeared to be functioning. I had a stable job, a partner who seemed good for me, a small circle of friends, and a daily routine that made me appear grounded. No one looking in would have suspected anything was wrong. That's the dangerous thing about internal wilderness. From the outside, you can look like a manicured garden. As long as you keep the surface tidy, no one thinks to ask what's growing beneath it. The moment that changed me was a morning like any other. I was drinking coffee at my kitchen table, sunlight filtering through the blinds in those pleasant golden stripes that make everything look more benign than it is. My partner was humming in the next room. There was nothing dramatic in the air. And yet, as I lifted the mug to my lips, something inside me went still. It wasn't fear, it wasn't sadness, it was recognition. Sudden and steady, like realizing you've been driving on autopilot and only just now noticed your hands on the wheel. The recognition was simple, almost mercilessly so. I was profoundly lost. Lost not because my life was bad, but because it wasn't mine. Lost because I had walked so far from my own instincts that I could no longer hear them. Lost because I had become an expert at performing stability, while internally I was drifting like a leaf on water, directionless and numb. People assume that you'll feel panic when you realize you're lost, but sometimes the more honest reaction is relief. Relief that the truth has finally stepped into the light, no matter how inconvenient it is. Relief that you can stop pretending ignorance. That morning, I didn't cry, I didn't make any sudden decisions, I didn't declare that I would overhaul my entire life. I simply sat there and acknowledged the wilderness. I acknowledged that I didn't know the way back to myself. It was the first honest moment I'd had in months, maybe years, and honesty, however small, is the first sign that you've stopped resisting the terrain. The wilderness within doesn't frighten me the way it once did. But that acceptance didn't come easily. It came from walking directly into the places I'd avoided, the memories I'd labeled unimportant, the desires I'd belittled, the anger I'd swallowed, the loneliness I'd disguised with busyness. For a long time, I believed I needed to fix all of those things, as though they were broken branches I could simply clear from the path. But the inner wilderness isn't a problem to solve, it's a landscape to know. And knowing is far more demanding than fixing. People often ask me, usually with a mix of desperation and hope, how to begin exploring their inner world without being overwhelmed by it. They want a method, a checklist, a survival kit. But self-leadership doesn't follow procedural steps. The first act is simply willingness, the willingness to sit with what you feel instead of escaping it, the willingness to tell the truth even when it shatters your old narratives. The willingness to let discomfort be a teacher instead of an enemy. It sounds simple, and it is, but simple doesn't mean easy. When you first step into your internal wilderness, you'll want to bring a machete. You'll want to cut down everything that looks threatening. But if you approach your inner world with force, the terrain only grows more tangled. The parts of yourself you're at war with don't vanish, they burrow deeper. I learned this the hard way. Every time I tried to fix my fear of disappointing people, I ended up choking myself with guilt. Every time I tried to eliminate my anxieties, they came back sharper. Every attempt to dominate myself made me smaller. Self-leadership begins with curiosity rather than conquest. When you feel jealousy, for example, instead of punishing yourself for the emotion, you ask what it's trying to show you about your unclaimed desires. When you feel shame rising like a wave, instead of drowning beneath it, you examine where you learned that shame and whether it truly belongs to you. When you freeze in indecision, instead of judging yourself as weak, you ask what risk your inner world is trying to protect you from. The wilderness becomes navigable when you stop treating every emotional creature inside you as a threat. One of the most humbling realizations I've had is that most of my inner turmoil wasn't rooted in weakness. It was rooted in self-protection. Every coping mechanism I despised, the avoidance, the overthinking, the people-pleasing, had once been a survival strategy. They weren't evidence of failure, they were evidence of endurance. But strategies that protect you in childhood often imprison you in adulthood. Recognizing that is a turning point, because once you understand the origin of your patterns, you gain the power to choose whether they still serve you. I remember a day during one of my wilderness courses when a student panicked after losing sight of the group for less than 10 minutes. When I found her, she was breathing like the world was collapsing, tears streaking her cheeks. She kept saying, "I knew I'd get lost. I always get lost." I realized her fear had nothing to do with the terrain around her. She was fighting an old story, a belief that she was incapable of finding her own way. The wilderness merely exposed the narrative she carried. Guiding her wasn't about pointing out the trail. It was about helping her see the story she'd been repeating, long after its usefulness expired. Your inner wilderness functions the same way. It reveals the stories you've been telling yourself, stories inherited from family, from society, from old wounds, stories that dictate what you believe you can have, who you believe you can be, and how small you're willing to make yourself to stay safe. You don't transform those stories by force. You transform them by recognizing them and choosing differently, one small step at a time. The reason people avoid their inner world is not because it's unbearable. It's because it's intimate. It asks you to acknowledge your own agency and your own contradictions. It asks you to admit the ways you've abandoned yourself. It asks you to stop blaming external circumstances for internal stagnation. That kind of honesty feels like standing naked in a storm, but it also cleanses. It strips away pretense. It leaves you with the raw material of who you are, which is the only material you can actually build a life from. Self-leadership means learning the terrain instead of fearing it. It means knowing where your emotional cliffs are so you can navigate them without falling. It means understanding the difference between the instinct that protects you and the fear that confines you. It means having the courage to sit in discomfort until it reveals what lies beneath it. And it means accepting that you will always be, in some way, a student of your own interior world. You don't emerge from your inner wilderness with a trophy or a certificate or a neatly resolved identity. You emerge with something much quieter and more powerful. Familiarity. You know your own shadows. You know your own light. You know what pulls you forward and what pulls you under. You know yourself not as a project, but as a landscape. Alive, shifting, sometimes unpredictable, but navigable. When you stop fearing your internal wilderness, it stops controlling you. When you start walking through it with presence instead of avoidance, something remarkable happens. Paths appear, direction emerges, and that whisper of instinct you once ignored becomes a voice you can finally hear. That, more than anything, is the beginning of self-leadership. Not mastery, not certainty, but companionship with yourself, a willingness to walk into your own depths and say, "I'm here, I'm listening, I won't leave." And once you can say that, the wilderness stops feeling like an enemy. It becomes a home you're finally learning to inhabit. Chapter 3, Owning Your Story. There comes a point in every person's life when the story they've been telling themselves stops holding together. Sometimes it frays slowly, like an old sweater coming undone at the hem. Other times it splits open with a violent tear you didn't see coming. Either way, owning your story requires you to notice the gap between the life you've narrated and the life you're actually living. It requires you to take hold of the threads and decide, with painful honesty, whether you're willing to weave something truer or whether you'll spend the rest of your days pretending the unraveling isn't happening. Most people choose the latter. Familiar illusions are often easier to bear than unfamiliar truths. For years, I walked around with a story that looked admirable from a distance. I was the competent one, the strong one, the unshakable one. At least, that's how I wanted others to see me. I built my identity like a fortress, brick by brick, each wall made from a polished narrative about who I believed I was supposed to be. I told myself I was resilient because I'd learned to endure, I told myself I was confident because I had mastered certain skills. I told myself I was independent because I didn't lean on anyone. But none of that touched the deeper truth simmering beneath the surface. I wasn't living with strength. I was living with armor. Armor looks heroic in the stories we consume. Shining metal, indestructible shields, the kind of gear that announces power. But the truth about armor is that it's heavy. It limits your movement. It exhausts you over time. And worst of all, it prevents you from feeling. My story was forged from the need to be untouchable, and I wore it so well that I forgot how much of myself I'd sealed away just to maintain the illusion. People praised me for my steadiness, my reliability, my instincts. They never saw the private cost of my performance. They never saw the weight I carried to keep the world convinced. The moment you begin to own your story is the moment you admit the parts you've left out. This isn't a confession required by anyone else. It isn't an exercise in shame or self-flagellation. It's an act of reclamation. When you finally acknowledge the chapters you've avoided, the regrets you pretend don't sting anymore, the relationships you stayed in too long, the ambitions you abandoned because failure felt unbearable, you begin to step back into your own narrative with clarity instead of denial. That's when self-leadership becomes possible. You can't lead a life you refuse to name. The first time I confronted one of my missing chapters, it surprised me. The memory wasn't a dramatic crisis, or a heartbreak, or a betrayal. It was a quiet afternoon from my early 20s, a time I barely thought about. I was sitting in my car outside a cafe, hands on the steering wheel, unable to walk inside because I was terrified of being judged by a group of people I desperately wanted to impress. I remember telling myself I was just tired, that I'd go in after a few minutes, that I simply needed to gather my thoughts. The truth, which I refused to admit at the time, was that I felt small. I felt unworthy. I felt like an imposter in my own skin. I never acknowledged that moment because it didn't fit the story I preferred. It didn't match the narrative of confidence I was so committed to embodying. That forgotten scene began to resurface years later, and with it came a cascade of similar moments I had tucked away. Each memory was a stone in the foundation of the story I had built to protect myself. And each stone told a different truth than the glossy script I outwardly recited. I hide the idea unconsciously, but without truth, the story I outwardly recited. It took me a long time to understand that owning your story doesn't mean condemning yourself for the mistakes you've made or the versions of yourself you once inhabited. It means recognizing that every version of you was doing the best it could with the knowledge and resources available. It means seeing your past not as evidence of inadequacy, but as the context that shaped your survival. Once you accept that, the shame softens, the judgment loosens, and something new becomes possible, integration. Integration is the quiet act of gathering your scattered selves, the brave, the scared, the foolish, the hopeful, the broken, the resilient, and allowing them to coexist in your understanding of who you are. People talk about becoming whole as though it's a single transformation, a neat before and after, but wholeness is simply the absence of denial. You stop splitting yourself into fragments. You stop hiding the parts that don't photograph well. You let the truth breathe. One of the most profound shifts in my life came when I realized I didn't have to keep performing someone else's version of strength. My real strength wasn't in suppressing my uncertainty, but in acknowledging it. My real confidence wasn't in appearing unshakable, but in learning to trust myself even when my voice trembled. My real resilience wasn't in staying silent, but in speaking honestly about the places that hurt. Owning my story meant rewriting the definition of strength in terms I could actually live with. There's a moment in wilderness training when students transition from fear to awareness. It's subtle, but unmistakable. They stop saying, "I shouldn't be afraid," and start saying, "This is what fear feels like in my body." That shift matters because it transforms fear from a personal flaw into a piece of information. The same is true when you confront your story. Instead of saying, "This shouldn't have happened," you say, "This happened and it shaped me." That acknowledgement turns chaos into meaning, and meaning into power. But let's be honest, owning your story also requires giving up the comfort of your old narratives. Maybe you've been telling yourself you're too broken to change. Maybe you've been narrating your life as though everything is someone else's fault. Maybe you've clung to the identity of the wounded one, or the misunderstood one, or the always strong one, because the alternative feels too exposed. These roles are seductive, because they give us something to hold on to. Letting them go feels like stepping out onto thin ice. And yet there is no leadership without the willingness to lead yourself beyond the story that keeps you small. One of the biggest myths about self-growth is that once you recognize an unhelpful story, you can immediately rewrite it. But stories resist change, especially the ones that protected you for years. They'll whisper reasons to hold on. They'll promise you safety if you stay the same. They'll disguise themselves as truth. The real work is not replacing the story, but questioning it, patiently, consistently, courageously. It's asking yourself, is this narrative helping me grow, or is it keeping me from moving? Is this belief mine, or did someone else plant it in me? Does this version of me still feel true? The answers aren't always comfortable, but they are always liberating. When you begin owning your story, you also begin seeing how much of your life has been shaped by narratives you never consciously chose. You start noticing the beliefs you inherited, the roles you were assigned, the expectations you absorbed without questioning. You see how many of your decisions were made to maintain an identity rather than express your truth, and you start to feel the quiet grief of realizing you lived entire chapters of your life in someone else's voice. But grief isn't the enemy. Grief is the signal that something inside you is ready to change. I've watched people break open under the weight of their own unspoken story. I've also watched them rise in ways they never believed they could once they began telling the truth, to themselves first, and eventually to others. Self-leadership doesn't require you to broadcast your story to the world. It simply asks you to stop hiding from it. You can't lead a life you're unwilling to claim. Your story is yours. Messy, contradictory, jagged in places, luminous in others. It contains losses you didn't deserve, choices you regret, moments of courage you overlooked, and small victories that shaped you more than you realized. It contains every version of you that tried to survive. To own it is not to glorify it or to erase its wounds. It's to recognize that your power isn't found in perfect chapters. It's found in honest ones. When you choose to face your story, you stop being a character pushed along by old scripts. You become an author again, not rewriting the past, but reclaiming your agency in the present. You step out of the armor you no longer need. You feel the rawness of your own humanity. You see yourself clearly, perhaps for the first time, and from that clarity, you begin to lead. Not perfectly, not seamlessly, but with truth. And truth once spoken has a way of pulling you forward into a life that finally feels like it belongs to you. Chapter 4. The Discipline of Honesty. There is a strange tenderness in the moment you finally tell yourself the truth. It doesn't always arrive with drama. Sometimes it slips in quietly like a visitor you forgot you invited, sitting down at your kitchen table as though it belongs there. Other times it barges through the door with unwelcome clarity, knocking over whatever fragile excuses you've used to hold your life together. But regardless of how it enters, honesty has a way of altering the temperature of your inner world. It is both a balm and a blade, gentle enough to heal you, sharp enough to change you. Many people assume honesty is a feeling, something that rises naturally when the time is right. But honesty, the real kind, not the convenient half-truths or the polished answers or the stories crafted for approval, is a discipline. It's something you practice even when it makes you squirm. It's something you return to when your mind starts spinning narratives designed to protect your image rather than your growth. It's uncomfortable, exhausting at times, and more revealing than most of us are prepared to handle. But without honesty, self-leadership collapses like a tent without stakes. You can build a life on illusions, but you cannot build a life you trust. I used to believe I was an honest person because I never lied to others. That was the story I proudly carried. I valued transparency, directness, integrity. I could call out injustice or hypocrisy without flinching. I could give feedback with clarity and receive it without theatrics. But the truth I refused to admit was that while I was honest outwardly, I was evasive inwardly. I lied to myself with remarkable skill, not in bold, obvious ways, the kind that make you feel dirty or wrong, but in subtle, almost elegant ways. I softened truths that hurt, exaggerated ones that justified my choices, ignored the ones that contradicted the identity I clung to, and polished uncomfortable realities until they were unrecognizable. I lied when I told myself I was staying in certain relationships out of loyalty rather than fear. I lied when I convinced myself the exhaustion in my bones was normal, that burnout was simply dedication, that self-neglect was a noble sacrifice. I lied when I insisted I didn't care about certain dreams because the thought of failing at them felt unbearable. These lies were soft, almost gentle, the kind that protect you from truths you're not ready to face. But gentle lies are still lies, and over time they accumulate, forming a kind of fog that clouds every decision you make. The discipline of honesty begins the moment you decide to stop negotiating with your own avoidance. The first time I fully committed to that discipline, I felt like I was cutting open my own chest with trembling hands. It happened during a long hike on a trail I'd walked dozens of times, the route so familiar I could navigate it blindfolded. That day, however, the familiarity felt suffocating. My legs were moving, but something in me wasn't moving at all. There was a heaviness behind my ribs, a tension between my shoulder blades that had nothing to do with the pack on my back. I stopped on a ridge overlooking the valley below, wind brushing against my cheeks, the scent of pine heavy in the air. I don't know what triggered it, but something broke open inside me. Maybe it was the quiet, maybe it was the view, maybe it was the fact that I'd been holding too much for too long. Whatever the cause, I heard myself whisper the truth I had refused to say. I'm not okay. I'm tired of pretending I am. Those five words felt like a confession and a liberation at once. They cracked the shell of the identity I'd been carrying, and once the crack appeared, honesty poured through it with startling force. I admitted I was staying in a life I had outgrown because I feared disappointing people. I admitted I had ignored my own needs so consistently that I no longer recognized them. I admitted I wanted change, deep, disruptive change, but had been pretending contentment because it felt safer than stepping into the unknown. Honesty does not destroy you. It destroys the version of you that was never real to begin with. Once you begin practicing honest self-confrontation, the world changes shape around you. You hear your own thoughts differently. You notice the subtle ways you bend your truth to fit circumstances. You catch yourself mid-avoidance, mid-excuse, mid-dismissal. And although it's uncomfortable, it is also profoundly grounding. Honesty is the compass that points you back to yourself without fail. But like any compass, it requires you to stop long enough to read it. People often ask me how to know whether they are being honest with themselves or simply reciting a convenient story. My answer is always the same. Honesty feels like clarity, even when it hurts. Convenient stories feel like relief, temporary and fragile, dissolving the moment someone questions them. Honesty sits in your body with weight, not heaviness. It feels like something settling into place, and it often arrives with a mixture of discomfort and relief. Discomfort because it disrupts your illusions, relief because it frees you from pretending. But let me be clear, honesty is not brutality. Many people confuse the two. They treat honesty as an excuse to berate themselves, to magnify their flaws, to strip themselves bare without compassion. That is not honesty. That is self-violence disguised as truth-telling. Real honesty is grounded in clarity, not cruelty. It acknowledges your imperfections without turning them into weapons. It allows you to see yourself whole, not shattered. One of the most profound shifts I witnessed as a wilderness instructor was the way fear distorts perception. A person lost in the woods will swear they saw threats that weren't there. A shadow becoming a predator, a rustle becoming danger, a slope becoming a cliff. Their senses amplify everything because fear is a liar with a loud voice. The same happens internally. When you're afraid of the truth, you inflate it until it seems unmanageable. The discipline of honesty brings those shadows into the light, revealing them for what they are. Discomforts, not catastrophes. I once worked with a student who insisted she was terrible at navigation. Every time she came to a crossroads, she froze, convinced she would choose wrong. When I asked her what made her believe she was incapable, she said, "It's just who I am." But after spending time with her, I realized it wasn't incapability. It was a story she'd adopted to avoid the discomfort of making decisions. When she finally told herself the truth, that she was afraid of taking responsibility for her direction, something in her shifted. She still hesitated at crossroads, but she hesitated honestly. And in that honesty, she began to learn. Honesty isn't glamorous. It doesn't feel triumphant in the beginning. It feels like stepping into cold water, shocking the system, making every nerve stand at attention. But once you submerge yourself in it, the water warms. You acclimate. And then something surprising happens. You begin to crave the cold because you realize it wakes you up. When you commit to honesty, you also commit to discomfort. You commit to seeing the ways you've kept yourself small, the excuses you've leaned on, the patterns you've repeated long past their usefulness. You commit to acknowledging the versions of yourself you're not proud of. But honesty doesn't trap you in those truths. It frees you from them. Once something is named, it loses its hold. The discipline of honesty also demands boundaries. With yourself, you can't keep promising you'll start showing up differently and then continue behaving the same way. You can't call something a priority and then refuse to give it space. You can't claim you value growth and then avoid every uncomfortable truth that stands between you and that growth. Integrity begins in your inner world long before it becomes visible in your outer one. And yet, perhaps the most difficult part of honesty is admitting what you want. Desire is a frightening thing to own. We're taught that wanting more is greedy, selfish, unrealistic. So we pretend we don't want the relationship that scares us with its depth. We pretend we don't want the career that feels out of reach. We pretend we don't want rest because exhaustion has become a badge of honor. But denying your desires doesn't make you virtuous, it makes you lost. The truth of what you want is often the compass toward who you are becoming. For years, I told myself I was content with a life that looked good on paper. I convinced myself that wanting something different would make me ungrateful. I softened my dreams until they were manageable, then convinced myself they were all I needed. That lie kept me safe, but it kept me small. When I finally admitted what I truly wanted, a life that felt alive, aligned, and wholly mine, I felt both terrified and electrified. Honesty shook the ground under my feet, but it also revealed a path I could finally see. If you're serious about self-leadership, you must practice honesty daily. Not occasionally, not only when it's convenient, daily. You must ask yourself questions that many people spend their entire lives avoiding. Questions like, what am I pretending not to know? What truth am I afraid to acknowledge? What feeling have I been numbing? What desire have I silenced? What responsibility have I avoided? These questions aren't comfortable, but they are liberating. They pull you back into alignment. They give you access to your own wisdom. They remind you that clarity is something you earn through courage, not something you wait for passively. Honesty is the foundation of self-leadership. Because you cannot lead yourself from a place of distortion, you cannot make aligned decisions if you're basing them on a story you haven't examined. You cannot build a life that feels true if you're unwilling to face your own truth. But here's the part people often overlook. Honesty is a kindness. It is a kindness to stop pretending you are fine when you're not. It is a kindness to stop forcing yourself into lives that don't fit. It is a kindness to let your truth breathe, even when it disrupts the image you've built. It is a kindness to yourself and to the people who love you. Because when you show up honestly, you give them permission to do the same. Practicing honesty does not make life easier, but it makes life yours. And there is profound relief in living a life you don't have to constantly justify or hide from. The discipline of honesty is not something you master. It's something you return to again and again, with the willingness to listen and the courage to act. It is the quiet promise you make to yourself, one that says, "I will not abandon my truth, even when it's inconvenient." And when you make that promise and keep it, your life begins to shift in ways that feel less like effort and more like alignment. The path becomes clearer, the choices become simpler, the noise quiets, and the person you are becoming steps forward with a steadiness you can finally trust. Chapter 5. Listening Beneath the Noise. There's a particular kind of quiet you only learn to appreciate after your life has become too loud to bear. It's not the quiet of an empty house or a morning before anyone else wakes. It's not even the hush of the woods at dusk when the wind settles and the animals retreat into their own rhythms. The quiet I'm talking about is internal, an atmosphere inside your chest where your thoughts slow enough that you can actually hear yourself. Most people spend their entire lives avoiding that kind of quiet without realizing they're doing it. They fill every spare second with distraction, as if silence is dangerous. And in a way, it is. Silence will tell you what your noise has been drowning out. I used to be terrified of quiet. Not consciously, I would have told you I loved solitude, loved long drives with nothing but the hum of the engine, loved walking through the forest without a word spoken. But those were external silences. Inside, I kept myself busy with thoughts, planning, analyzing, rehearsing conversations that would never happen. My mind was a crowded marketplace, vendors shouting, people pushing, the constant jostling of ideas, worries, possibilities. I clung to the noise because noise feels like movement and movement feels like control. But movement isn't leadership and noise isn't truth. Listening beneath the noise requires slowing down enough to let the mind's chaos settle. At first, it feels impossible. You sit still, intending to be present, and immediately your thoughts begin circling like restless animals. What am I forgetting? What should I be doing? Why is this taking so long? The mind hates stillness. Stillness creates space, and space reveals things you've carefully buried. That's why the people most in need of quiet are often the most resistant to it. I remember a day years ago when I decided dramatically and somewhat naively that I was going to spend an entire afternoon listening to myself. I sat on a fallen log near a creek, feeling very intentional, very spiritual, very earnest in my desire to connect with some deeper wisdom. Within minutes, I was irritated. Within 10, I was restless. By the end of the first hour, I had mentally rewritten my entire to-do list, evaluated 3 old conversations, imagined 5 future disasters, and convinced myself this practice was pointless. I barely heard a thing. Except that wasn't quite true. Somewhere between the mental chattering and the impatience, a thin voice, one I had ignored for months, slipped through. It didn't say anything profound. It didn't offer a revelation. It simply said, gently and without accusation, "I don't want this life anymore." I had been too busy pretending everything was fine to let that truth surface, But the quiet made it unavoidable. I didn't know what to do with it yet, but I could no longer pretend it wasn't there. Listening beneath the noise isn't about chasing dramatic insights. It's about learning to recognize the signals your deeper self has been sending all along. Those signals are subtle because they were designed to protect you. If they came as thunderclaps, you'd resist them with everything you have. Instead, they come as discomfort, restlessness, a particular heaviness before certain decisions, a lightness before others, a quiet tug in the chest when something isn't right. We treat these sensations as inconveniences. We rationalize them away. But they're compass points, each one offering information you can't access through logic alone. Early in my career as a wilderness instructor, I learned that the body picks up on environmental cues long before the conscious mind does. You feel the air shift before a storm is visible. You adjust your footing before you're aware the slope is changing. You sense danger before you can explain it. The mind likes to believe it's the primary navigator, but the body is the one attuned to the landscape. The same is true internally. The body often knows the truth before the mind admits it. But the body speaks quietly and the mind speaks loudly, and most people trust volume over wisdom. Listening beneath the noise means learning to differentiate between the voice of fear and the voice of intuition. Fear is loud, urgent, insistent. It speaks in absolutes. It warns of disaster, humiliation, loss. Fear speaks in a tone that demands obedience. Intuition, on the other hand, is quiet. It doesn't argue. It doesn't issue threats. It offers a direction the same way a trail offers a path. Subtle, steady, patient. Fear pushes. Intuition pulls. Fear yells. Intuition hums. But you can only hear the hum if you're willing to be still. There is a moment with nearly every student I've guided, whether in the wilderness or in later years during personal development workshops, when they realize they've been confusing agitation with instinct. They'll insist, "My gut is telling me to turn back," when what's actually happening is that the fear of being lost overrides their ability to sense the land. Once they breathe, once they soften, once they let the panic settle, something remarkable happens. They start to hear themselves accurately. Their senses adjust. They feel the slope of the earth, hear the direction of the wind, notice the familiar bend of a tree branch. Their intuition wasn't absent before. It was simply drowned out by fear's volume. Inside ourselves, we circle the same patterns. We mistake urgency for truth. We assume any feeling that arrives with force must be correct. But the deepest truths rarely shout. They wait. One of the hardest truths I've had to accept is that listening is an act of courage. It means willingly entering a silence where your own contradictions will rise to the surface. Maybe you'll hear the longing you've ignored. Maybe you'll hear the exhaustion you've been pretending you can outrun. Maybe you'll hear the dream you dismissed because it felt too large. Maybe you'll hear grief you abandoned somewhere along the way. Whatever the truth is, it will reveal itself only when you stop filling every space with noise. Listening beneath the noise also requires patience, something I have not always been generous with. I wanted answers quickly. I wanted clarity immediately. I treated self-awareness like a task I could complete with enough effort. But listening is not effort. It's receptivity. You don't force insight. You make space for it. You create conditions where truth can emerge on its own timeline. Try rushing that process, and all you'll hear is your own impatience echoing back at you. Life has a way of amplifying the noise when you're unwilling to hear yourself. The more you ignore your inner signals, the louder they become, manifesting as irritability, burnout, numbness, indecision. These aren't failures, they're alarms. They tell you something inside requires attention. They tell you that you've drifted away from yourself. But we're conditioned to silence those alarms with productivity, with relationships, with perfectionism, with distractions packaged as self-improvement. We become so practiced at drowning out our own truth that eventually we forget it's even there. If you want to lead yourself, you must learn to listen the way you would listen to the wilderness, with curiosity, with humility, with awareness that the unfamiliar isn't necessarily dangerous. When you walk through a forest, you don't demand it speak on command. You tune yourself to its language. You observe before interpreting. You listen before acting. Your inner world deserves the same respect. Listening beneath the noise doesn't promise answers. It promises intimacy with yourself, with your instincts, with the parts of you that have been waiting for your attention. It gives you the kind of clarity that isn't loud, but is unmistakably true. It helps you make decisions not from fear, but from alignment. It teaches you to trust the quiet voice inside you that has been drowned out by years of internal shouting. When you begin this practice, the noise won't disappear. Your mind will still chatter. Your fears will still raise their hands. Your old narratives will still try to steer the conversation. But over time, with patience, you'll start to hear something beneath it all. Something steadier, wiser, softer. That voice isn't new. It's ancient. It's the part of you that has always known the way, even when you insisted you were lost. Listening beneath the noise is not a skill you master. It's a relationship you cultivate. It's a daily return to yourself, a willingness to pause, a willingness to hear the truth, even when you don't yet know what to do with it. And once you begin to hear that quiet voice, once you recognize its tone, its rhythm, its authenticity, you'll realize something that changes everything. You were never as lost as you thought. You just couldn't hear yourself over the noise. Chapter 6. Navigating fear without surrendering to it. Fear is one of the oldest companions we have as human beings. It's not glamorous or poetic. It's primal, mechanical, wired into us long before we were capable of language or reason. Fear kept our ancestors alive when survival meant reading shadows for predators and listening for the snap of a twig in the dark. Fear is not the enemy we make it out to be. It's not immoral or weak. It's not a flaw in your character. Fear is simply a signal, a biological alarm that says, pay attention, something matters here. The trouble begins when fear becomes the driver instead of the messenger. Most people don't actually fear the thing they name. They fear the meaning they've attached to it. I once worked with a man who insisted he was terrified of failure. He had built his entire life around avoiding it, constructing a career so stable it suffocated him. But when we peeled back the layers, he wasn't afraid of failure itself. He was afraid of what he believed failure confirmed about him, that he was inadequate, unworthy, a disappointment. Fear had become a distorted mirror, reflecting not reality but his own unexamined story. I've spent enough time in the wilderness to know that fear behaves predictably when you understand its patterns. When you're hiking alone in a place where you aren't the apex predator, fear sharpens your senses. It tenses your muscles. It keeps you alert. But it doesn't paralyze you unless you let it take over the internal narrative. I've watched new hikers freeze at the sound of a rustle in the brush, convinced danger is inches away. Their minds gallop toward catastrophe long before anything tangible appears. Meanwhile, seasoned hikers hear the same rustle and simply pause. They notice, they assess, they continue. They don't surrender to the story fear tries to tell. The same dynamic unfolds in our internal wilderness. Something unfamiliar arises. A new dream, a difficult conversation, a risk you know you need to take, and fear rushes in with its chorus of warnings. It paints vivid outcomes of embarrassment, rejection, loss, ruin. The possibilities feel so convincing that you mistake them for inevitabilities. And before you take a single step, you've surrendered, not to reality, but to fear's vivid imagination. Fear thrives on momentum. It grows most powerful when we give it the final word. One of the most liberating lessons I ever learned came during a night spent alone in the backcountry. It was part of a required solo for instructors, a test of both skill and emotional resilience. I'd set up camp near a stand of fir trees, the ground soft with fallen needles. At dusk, as the last light evaporated behind the ridgeline, I felt the familiar tightening in my chest. I'd taught countless students how to manage fear in the wilderness. I'd told them fear was normal, expected, even useful. But that night, my own advice felt like a thin thread between me and panic. Every sound seemed magnified. Every rustle seemed sinister. My mind began constructing possibilities. A bear wandering into camp, a sudden storm, a branch snapping off a tree and falling onto my tent. It didn't take long for fear to escalate into a full internal monologue. What if something goes wrong and no one finds me? What if I can't get to safety in time? What if I'm not as competent as I thought? Halfway through this mental spiral, a thought broke through. Quiet, steady, undeniable. Nothing is happening. Only your mind is. That was the moment something shifted. I realized I had been reacting to fear as though it were fact. I had surrendered to an imagined disaster instead of responding to the actual moment in front of me, which was calm, still, and completely manageable. The wind hadn't changed, the temperature hadn't dropped, no animals were approaching, my body was safe. The only threat was the story fear was spinning. I made myself sit in the darkness and simply breathe. I listened not to the thoughts, but to the space beneath them. Bit by bit, the panic lost its grip. Fear didn't disappear, but it softened. It became information instead of a verdict. A sensation instead of a prophecy. That night taught me something essential. Courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is the refusal to obey fear when it behaves like a tyrant. Most people think fear needs to be conquered or eliminated. They imagine courage as a kind of internal warfare where the strongest emotion wins. But fear is not an intruder. It's a part of you, a part trying, however clumsily, to protect you. You don't conquer fear, you learn to navigate it. Navigating fear requires three commitments: awareness, acceptance, and agency. Awareness is the part where you recognize fear's presence without judging it. Acceptance is the part where you allow fear to exist without trying to silence or suppress it. Agency is the part where you choose your response with intention rather than reactivity. Awareness is often the hardest step because fear tends to disguise itself. It wears costumes. Sometimes fear looks like procrastination. Sometimes it looks like perfectionism. Sometimes it looks like anger or ambivalence or overcommitment. It takes practice to recognize fear's many forms, especially the quiet ones. I've watched people ruin their own opportunities because fear masqueraded as practicality. I've watched them stay in stagnant relationships because fear disguised itself as loyalty. I've watched them shrink their dreams because fear convinced them the timing wasn't right. Fear doesn't always shout. Sometimes it whispers reasonable-sounding lies. Acceptance is where most of us stumble. We treat fear as an indictment, as proof that we're weak or broken or unprepared. But fear is just a signal. It doesn't need to be eradicated. It needs to be acknowledged. When you accept fear, you stop fighting it, and when you stop fighting it, you free up the energy to actually respond. Acceptance doesn't mean resignation. It means, I see you, and I am choosing my path anyway. Agency is where self-leadership becomes visible. It's the difference between reacting and responding. Reacting is what fear wants, impulsive, protective, often self-sabotaging. Responding is what alignment requires, calm, grounded, and rooted in intention rather than panic. Responding doesn't mean you won't feel afraid. It means you've decided fear won't decide for you. When I look back at the biggest turning points in my life, every one of them was preceded by fear. Leaving a relationship that no longer aligned with the person I was becoming, pursuing a career path that didn't guarantee approval, stepping into deeper vulnerability in relationships, speaking truths I knew would disappoint people, choosing rest when productivity felt like my only value. Every one of these moments required walking with fear instead of letting it drag me backward. Self-leadership is not about becoming fearless. Fearlessness is not a sustainable or desirable state. People without fear take reckless actions. They miss danger signs. They confuse stubbornness with bravery. What you want is not fearlessness, but fear literacy. You want to understand fear well enough to know when to listen to it and when to challenge it. You want to know when fear is a wise warning and when it's an echo from an old wound. You want to be able to say, "I hear you, but I'm choosing differently." There's a moment in any challenging journey, whether physical or emotional, when fear swells and your instinct is to retreat. The path ahead feels too steep, too uncertain, too revealing. That moment is where your leadership begins. Anyone can walk the path when it's lit and level. The person you become is shaped in the moments when the path narrows and the shadows lengthen and fear begins its familiar chant. Turn back. It's not worth the risk. You're not ready. When you choose to continue anyway, not rushing forward, not bulldozing over your fear, but walking steadily with it, you build something far more powerful than confidence. You build trust in yourself. Confidence is loud. Trust is quiet. Confidence says, "I can handle anything." Trust says, "Even if I can't, I'll find my way." Fear becomes manageable when you stop letting it dictate the narrative. And that begins with a single steady decision, to stay present in the moment you're in, rather than the future your fear has imagined. The present is almost always solvable. The imagined future rarely is. Navigating fear without surrendering to it is a lifelong practice, not a one-time victory. Some days you'll manage it with grace. Other days you'll be swept up in fear's tide before you can catch your breath. But every time you return to yourself, every time you pause, breathe, and reorient, you strengthen the part of you that leads rather than react. Fear may always walk beside you, but it does not have to lead. Your task is simple, though not easy. Listen to fear's warning without obeying its commands. Let it speak, but do not let it steer. And as you practice this, again and again, you'll discover something unexpected. Fear is not there to stop you. It is there to illuminate what matters. If you can learn to walk with it rather than under it, you'll find that many of the paths fear once obscured become not only navigable, but necessary. Chapter 7. Choosing Your North Star. There comes a point in every journey, inner or outer, when you realize you can't keep stumbling forward without some sense of direction. You can have all the insight in the world, all the honesty, all the courage, all the clarity about what you don't want, and still find yourself drifting because you haven't yet committed to where you're going. People imagine that clarity arrives like a revelation, as if one morning you wake up with a perfectly articulated vision of your life and the precise steps required to achieve it. But direction isn't found that way. It's chosen. And choosing it is one of the most intimate acts of self-leadership you'll ever undertake. Your North Star is not a goal. Goals are milestones, things you aim for and achieve and replace with new ones. Your North Star is the deeper orientation, an inner truth, a defining value, a way of being that doesn't shift each time your circumstances change. It's the thing that sits beneath your ambitions, beneath your fears, beneath the noise of other people's expectations. When you know your North Star, decisions become clearer, even if they remain difficult. When you don't, you end up living reactively, letting the strongest emotion or loudest voice determine your next step. That is how people lose years, not through failure or misfortune, but through drifting. I know something about drifting. There was a long stretch in my late 20s and early 30s when my life looked stable from the outside, but internally felt directionless. I kept myself busy with work, relationships, responsibilities, and the relentless maintenance of a persona I had outgrown. I moved through my days with competence, but competence is not the same as direction. I was doing 100 things right, but none of them felt rooted. It's a peculiar kind of exhaustion, being busy but unanchored. It feels like standing in the middle of a wide plain, able to walk in any direction but unable to commit to a single step, because none of them feel like home. One morning, in the middle of this disorientation, a mentor of mine asked a question that landed with surprising force. If no one ever judged you, if no eyes were on you, no consequences waiting, no reputation to uphold, what would you move toward? I opened my mouth to answer quickly out of habit, but nothing came, not because I didn't care about anything, but because I had spent so many years shaping myself around expectations mine and others that I had lost track of the thread that was uniquely mine. That question chased me for months. It followed me through routines, through conversations, through sleepless nights. It chased me until I stopped trying to outrun it and finally sat down to face it. What do you want, Mara, when no one else's approval is at stake? It's astonishing how quiet that question becomes behind the clamor of everyday living. It waits patiently, like a compass buried under debris. It doesn't demand an answer, it invites one. To choose a North Star, you must first recognize that you already have one. Buried, dimmed, obscured perhaps, but present. It shows itself in your longings, the ones you dismiss as impractical. It shows itself in the anger that rises when you violated your own values. It shows itself in the envy you feel toward lives that express something you're afraid to claim. It shows itself in the moments of unexpected peace, the rare, quiet seconds when your mind unclenches and you sense alignment, even if you can't yet articulate its shape. But finding your North Star isn't about chasing emotion. Emotions fluctuate. They mislead as often as they guide. What you're looking for is deeper, less dramatic, more consistent. A direction, not a destination. A calling, not a checklist. I used to believe purpose was something bestowed, something you discovered through years of searching or through some major life event that jolted everything into place. But purpose is less like a revelation and more like a decision. You decide what matters. You decide what you stand for. You decide which values will anchor you when the terrain gets rough. And then, day by day, you act in alignment with those decisions until they become the gravity that shapes your life. Your North Star is not loud. It won't compete with your fears or your obligations or the expectations piled on your shoulders. It won't chase you. It waits for you to turn toward it. And turning toward it often requires laying down the stories that have given you comfort. Stories like, I don't deserve more than this, or I'm too late to begin, or I shouldn't want that, or someone like me doesn't get to choose. Those stories may feel true, but they're not truth. They're remnants, leftover beliefs from earlier versions of you. Versions that were doing their best to navigate with whatever understanding they had at the time. You don't abandon those versions, you simply stop letting them steer. Choosing a North Star asks you to look beyond the survival patterns, beyond the obligations you've inherited, beyond the set of choices life has conditioned you to believe are the only ones available. It asks for imagination, not the whimsical kind, but the brave kind. The kind that says, what if I could orient my life towards something that actually feels like mine? I think of a woman I once coached, a brilliant, capable person whose life was packed with achievement, but empty of meaning. She kept waiting to feel a sense of fulfillment, convinced it would come if she accomplished one more thing, earned one more promotion, perfected one more facet of her identity. But the more she achieved, the more unmoored she felt. When we finally began talking about what she truly valued, not what she was praised for, not what she'd been taught to pursue, but what mattered to her at a soul level, she went silent. Not because she didn't know, but because she did, and admitting it meant rewriting her entire orientation. Her North Star wasn't success. It was connection. Everything in her life that felt hollow was missing that element. Once she admitted it, decisions that once felt paralyzing became clearer, not easier, but clearer. She began living with intention instead of momentum. And momentum without intention is one of the easiest ways to lose yourself. A North Star simplifies without oversimplifying. It doesn't make your life free of pain or doubt or struggle. It makes your struggle meaningful. It gives context to your choices. It keeps you anchored when fear tries to pull you in 5 different directions at once. It doesn't eliminate uncertainty, but it illuminates the next right step. Not the next 5 years, not the perfect plan, not the guaranteed outcome, just the next step. The trouble is, people often confuse a North Star with an image. They think choosing direction means choosing a lifestyle or a career or a single dream. But those are vehicles, not destinations. A North Star isn't a job title or a relationship status or a location on a map. It's a principle, a value, a truth you want your life to express. When people tie their identity to external markers, their direction collapses the moment those markers shift. A North Star is something internal, something life can't take from you because it's stitched into the fabric of who you are becoming. For me, my North Star became clarity and integrity of self, living in alignment with who I truly am, not who I believed I had to be. Once I committed to that orientation, everything in my life began to shift. Some things fell away naturally, like leaves shedding in a season I had outgrown. Other things I had to let go intentionally, which hurt more but mattered just as much. And slowly a new sense of direction formed, not linear, not perfect, but true. People underestimate how painful choosing a North Star can be. It often requires dismantling identities that once kept you safe. It requires disappointing people who benefited from your lack of direction. It requires taking responsibility for your choices rather than blaming circumstance. And it requires acknowledging the gap between the life you've built and the life you actually want. That gap is uncomfortable, but that gap is also where evolution begins. I wish someone had told me earlier that choosing direction is not a one-time event. It's a practice, much like honesty, courage, or self-trust. You choose your North Star again and again, especially on the days when you feel lost, especially on the days when fear is loud, especially on the days when the old stories try to reclaim you. Some days you'll drift. Some days you'll forget. Some days you'll fall back into old patterns. But each time you reorient, even with the smallest gesture, you strengthen the path beneath your feet. Your North Star is your commitment to yourself, not to who you were, not to who others expect you to be, but to who you are becoming. And becoming is not a passive process. It requires direction. It requires willingness. It requires choosing. Not once, but continually. If you're unsure of your North Star, begin with gentler questions. Ask yourself, when do I feel most alive? What do I protect instinctively? What do I grieve when I betray it? What quality do I want my life to embody? What truth, if I honored it, would change everything? Don't look for grand answers. Look for honest ones. Your North Star doesn't need to be poetic. It doesn't need to impress anyone. It only needs to pull you toward yourself. When you choose a direction, even if it's imperfect, even if you only understand it partially, you begin to move differently in the world. Your decisions gain weight. Your energy becomes focused. Your priorities reorganize themselves. You stop living reactively and start living intentionally. And here's the quiet miracle. When you choose your North Star, life begins to meet you halfway, not with guarantees, not with ease, but with openings. The right people show up. Opportunities appear that were invisible before. Challenges still arise, but you meet them with a steadier spine. Because you're no longer wandering blindly, You're walking with direction, even in the dark. Your North Star won't eliminate uncertainty, but it will give you something far more powerful, a reason to keep walking. Chapter 8. The Quiet Power of Boundaries. There's a certain myth we inherit without ever formally learning it, the idea that strength is measured by how much we can carry, how much we can endure, how much of ourselves we can give without breaking. Many of us grow up believing that saying yes is generosity, saying no is selfishness, and accommodating others is the moral high ground. It sounds noble, it even feels noble at first. Until one day you wake up and realize you've traded your inner life for the illusion of harmony, you become a beautifully functioning shell available for everyone but yourself. Boundaries are the antidote to that erosion, and yet they are so often misunderstood. People imagine boundaries as hard edges, defenses, walls built high to keep others out. But real boundaries aren't about distance, they're about clarity. They're not punishments or ultimatums, they're not threats or manipulations. Boundaries are the simple, courageous act of telling the truth about what you can hold, what you can offer, and what you need in order to remain whole. I didn't learn boundaries in a workshop or a book. I learned them the way many of us do, through the slow collapse of a life built on being endlessly available. There was a period when I said yes to everyone, friends, colleagues, strangers, students. If someone needed help, I didn't hesitate. I wasn't trying to be a martyr. I genuinely wanted to be useful. Being useful felt like purpose. Being useful felt like worth, and the more I gave, the more people praised me for my reliability, my generosity, my strength. Praise is a powerful sedative. It numbs the warning signs. But beneath the surface, the cracks were forming. I was tired in a way sleep couldn't fix. I felt stretched thin, like a map worn soft from too many hands. I told myself it was just a busy season, just a demanding job, just the cost of caring deeply. But the truth, which took me far too long to admit, was simpler. I had no boundaries because I had no practice in honoring myself. One evening, after a long day guiding a group through a survival exercise, I sat alone by the fire, exhausted down to the marrow. A student approached me, asking for help with something trivial, something that could have easily waited until morning. Without thinking, I said yes. My body wanted to say no. My mind wanted to say no, but the reflex was stronger than either. I watched myself stand up to assist her, and in that moment, I felt like I was watching a stranger, someone programmed, someone unable to interrupt the script. When I returned to the fire, one of my fellow instructors, a man who had a gift for reading people, looked at me with an expression that was neither judgment nor pity, just a quiet knowing. He said, "You're going to burn out if you don't make yourself a priority." I nodded, pretending I understood, pretending I was change, pretending I wasn't already burning. But the moment that truly woke me came weeks later. I had been juggling too many commitments, trying to support too many people, maintaining a facade of stability that no longer matched my reality. One night, overwhelmed to the point of shaking, I sat in my car in a grocery store parking lot and realized I had nothing left to give. Not because I didn't care about the people who needed me, but because I had hollowed myself out trying to be everything for everyone. And for the first time, instead of judging myself for that exhaustion, I felt grief. Grief for the parts of me I had abandoned to maintain an image of strength. Grief for the version of me that believed self-sacrifice was noble. Grief for the years I spent saying yes when a loving no would have been truer. That grief was the beginning of boundaries. People talk about boundaries as if they begin with confrontation, with difficult conversations, with declaring new limits. But boundaries start much earlier. They start with noticing, really noticing, what drains you, what hurts you, what tightens your chest with resentment, what leaves you feeling small, depleted, or invisible. Boundaries begin as internal recognition long before they become external expression. You cannot set a boundary you haven't acknowledged inwardly. One of the lies we tell ourselves is that we don't set boundaries because we're kind. But kindness without boundaries is not kindness, it's self-erasure. What many of us call generosity is often an attempt to earn approval. What we call loyalty is sometimes fear of being disliked. What we call flexibility is often a lifelong habit of abandoning ourselves to avoid conflict. Boundaries aren't a rejection of others. They're an acceptance of yourself. There's a lesson nature teaches again and again if you're paying attention. Everything has limits. Trees grow toward the sun, but they don't apologize for the shade they cast. Rivers flow with power, but they don't ask permission to carve their path. Animals defend their territory not because they're cruel, but because survival requires clarity about what sustains them. Nature isn't ashamed of its boundaries. Humans are the only creatures who feel guilty for honoring them. One of the reasons boundaries feel difficult is because they require you to take responsibility for your own well-being. As long as you say yes to everyone, you can tell yourself you're being a good person, a caring friend, a reliable partner. You can avoid the discomfort of conflict, the awkwardness of disappointing others, the vulnerability of stating your needs. But self-leadership demands responsibility. It asks you to stop outsourcing your exhaustion to circumstance and to see that you are participating in the very patterns that drain you. When I first started setting boundaries, I felt clumsy. I stumbled over my words. I over-explained. I apologized excessively. I tried to soften every no with layers of justification. But boundaries don't need justification. They need clarity. They need consistency. They need a quiet steadiness that comes from knowing you're protecting something important, yourself. What surprised me most was that once I began setting boundaries, my relationships changed, but not in the catastrophic way I feared. Some relationships deepened. People who valued me respected the boundaries because they understood they were an expression of integrity, not withdrawal. Others drifted, which hurt, but also clarified what had been unbalanced all along. Boundaries reveal who is committed to mutual respect and who was only invested in what you offered them. One of the greatest fears people have around boundaries is the fear of being misunderstood, of appearing cold, of seeming difficult, of disappointing others. But here's the quiet truth. If someone needs you to abandon yourself in order to feel loved, that is not love. It may be dependency, it may be familiarity, it may be convenience, but it is not love. Healthy boundaries do not push people away. They create conditions where connection can thrive without corrosion. When you lead yourself, your boundaries become not walls, but guideposts. They help you navigate relationships without losing yourself in them. They help you give without resentment. They help you rest without guilt. They help you work without self-betrayal. They help you stay aligned with your own values rather than being pulled into someone else's urgency. Boundaries are not rigid, they're responsive. They evolve with your capacity, your season of life, your emotional landscape. Some seasons you can give more, others you must preserve more. The goal is not perfection, it's self-honoring consistency. One of the biggest misconceptions is that boundaries require dramatic declarations or emotional confrontations, but often boundaries are quiet. They're the pause before you say yes. They're the conscious choice to step away from a dynamic that drains you. They're the decision not to explain yourself endlessly. They're the courage to protect your energy even when it disappoints someone. They're the moment you choose presence over pleasing. I found that boundaries also reveal the way we speak to ourselves. The internal boundary often comes first, the decision to no longer tolerate your own self-neglect. The decision to stop overcommitting because you're afraid of being unworthy. The decision to stop silencing your needs because you've been told they are burdens. The decision to stop letting fear of judgment dictate your choices. These internal boundaries are the foundation for every external boundary that follows. And once you begin honoring them, something subtle but powerful shifts. you start to feel rooted, less tossed around by emotions, expectations, obligations, more anchored in your own truth. You become less reactive, less resentful, less exhausted. Your yes becomes real because it's no longer coerced by fear or habit. Your no becomes clear because it comes from alignment, not avoidance. And here's the part people overlook. Boundaries create capacity. When you stop spreading yourself thin, you discover you actually have more to give, more presence, more warmth, more authenticity, not the surface-level availability that leaves you depleted, but a deeper presence that comes from being grounded. The quiet power of boundaries is that they help you come home to yourself. They return your energy to your own center. They create a life that feels inhabitable, not performative. And they free you from the endless cycle of stretching, pleasing, and disappearing that so many people mistake for love or loyalty. If you're unsure where to begin, start with the simplest practice. Listen to yourself. Notice the moment resentment stirs. Notice the tightening in your chest when you agree to something you don't want. Notice the heaviness after a conversation where you downplayed your needs. Notice the relief when you honor your limits. These sensations are your compass. They point you toward the boundaries you already know you need, even if you haven't yet named them. And when you start naming them, quietly, steadily, honestly, your life will shift in ways both subtle and profound, not because boundaries make everything easier, but because they make everything clearer. And clarity is one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself. You've just heard a fraction of what this journey holds. 8 chapters in, and you've already stepped into the raw, honest terrain of self-leadership. But the heart of the book is still ahead. The breakthroughs, the deeper reckonings, the chapters that stir something awake you didn't even know you'd buried. If these first chapters have touched you, the rest will stay with you. Mara Ellington's full story, her hard-earned lessons, her candid wisdom, her quiet fire, continues far beyond what we can fit into the audiobook here. The remaining chapters dive even deeper into courage, boundaries, resilience, self-trust, and the kind of inner transformation that can reshape the way you walk through your life. If you're ready to keep going, if you're ready to finish the journey, the full ebook is waiting for you. Visit audiobooksoffice.com to get your copy and continue the path of becoming the person you can finally count on. Your next chapter is there. Go meet it.